from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Krista Hendricks.
Today on the show, we're going to be talking about the exploration of space.
Yay!
Yay! And you remember last time you were telling me, like, oh, you're full of downer on shows. So that's going to be fun.
Yay!
We're going to have a first fun portion, and then we're going to talk about a big downer where white supremacists killed a whole bunch of Sikhs. That's the order of things. Yeah, we're going to end a bit downer, but here's what's cool. We're going to talk about what is Sikhism, what's the deal. By the way, I mean, I had to do some research because I had to admit, you know, I'm like, I wasn't really fully aware of what their deal was either. You know, I knew that they were from India, but, you know, it was a superficial thing for me because I could just see it. Because the majority of Sikhs are from India. You could definitely tell. I'm like, well, I mean, unless you're white supremacist, then I guess everybody's just colored. Yeah, so we're gonna be talking about those two things. But before we start the show, I want to mention the fact that it's probably not... Calgary's probably not the only place that is hot as balls. It's like that everywhere. I'm pretty sure that this year is going to break records for, summer heat. And I was reading an article that's kind of depressing that was like, yeah, not only is global warming real, but it's worse than we thought.
Whoa.
And it's worse in the sense that let's pretend you were rolling some dice, and that each time you roll the dice, you might have mild summer or cold winter, things like that, because weather patterns work a little bit like this, where it's very difficult for you to predict it. And where before you might have like a fairly even chance to have any kind of weather pattern, now it's like as if you roll the dice and there's one chance that you're going to get a mild summer, one chance you're going to get like a cold winter, and four chances that you're going to get like really stinking crazy warm. And that's the big problem, right? Because now like, oh, everything's shifting, and you're like, oh yeah, you know that unbearable heat and all the issues that come with it, rolling blackouts, over, consumption of power and all of the other greenhouse fucking gases that causes, yeah, that is not only very real, but just increasingly more frightening. And if that doesn't make your day worse, because let me just add that a little bit by saying that, you know, in countries like, say, China and India, where they're now trying to produce less soot. Because, you know, like Singapore was having some pretty crazy problems. Like, you can't even see the cityscape. It's so disgusting. And they're working to try to fix that. But if they do, they'll make climate change worse. Because to some degree, what we have is that all the soot that's created by this bad environmental policy means that the sunlight is actually being blocked by this sooty crap. And if they eliminate that and all we have are the greenhouse gases, that'll actually make it even worse. So, I don't know what to tell you. So, you know. Other than it's hot, and I hope that you're somewhere cool enjoying something cold as we slowly witness a fundamental change in our weather pattern, and who knows what that'll fucking lead to. Who knows? The legacy of humanity and the way that we change our environment is not unlike the way the bacteria changed the environment to create an oxygen-rich atmosphere we have today. So, what are we leaving behind?
On that downer...
Let's talk about other planets maybe that we can colonize. Let's talk about Mars. Now, while the Olympics were going on and everybody thought, hey, that's a big deal, even though me and Carissa are like, we don't give a shit. The one thing we did care about, by the way, happened many hundreds of thousands of kilometers, or millions of kilometers away, excuse me, in a little place called Mars.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to deal with the whole, like, we don't give a shit about the Olympics. I don't actually give a shit about the Olympics because we're not very nationalistic, but... I will say that there is one thing I love about the Olympics.
World togetherness?
No. No. I love that...
No, not at all. Not that shit.
No. Well, I mean, I think that is cool. But, I mean, the one thing I really love about the Olympics is it's triumph of the human body. And as, like, a circus performer, watching what can be done with the human body is very interesting.
Pushing the limits of it.
Seeing what people on the limits of
of a strong and coherent drug program combined with a lot of working out. Yes. Mm-hmm. What can those very precisely steroided athletes accomplish?
Whoa, that's controversial. I don't think most of them are steroided.
Yeah, I would say most of them are.
Don't they check for that?
Well, here's the thing. You want to know how they check for steroids? This is the crazy thing about steroids. Thing is, when you make a test, you can only really find what you're looking for. And you have a list of the types of steroids you can find. But the truth is, you can design your own steroid. It could be the Carissa steroid, and it can work in a specific way that can't really be detected. Or you could also drink a shitload of green tea, which does tend to mask the effects. There's tons of ways to get around it, especially if you're doing things like cycling off these drugs. Like a good example, Lance Armstrong, right? Wins like 7 Tour de France's, and the thing is, at the time of the drug test, it wasn't really that sophisticated, but now they went back and they tested, and they're like, we found all these substances that we couldn't find at the time, now they want to strip them of those titles, and I'm like, don't dig too far back, because you'll find that everyone does it. And the reason is not because people are cheaters in that sense, it's just that with most athletes, in fact, steroids use is not for muscle growth. Do you know what it's for? Recovery. It's because you're injured or things like that. Many steroids, including I think it's cortisones, actually inhibit muscle growth sometimes. So you can. It's not necessarily a matter of strength, although definitely we think of that, you know, steroids in terms of strength. But steroids do all kinds of things. They're the body fixer. They're amazing. They're like stem cells. They're awesome. So is someone not going to use it? I mean, when the difference is fractions of seconds and everybody else is, guess what you're doing. Sorry, everybody. I hate to crash, you know, crumble your illusions about it. But I've covered sports a long time, you know, mixed martial arts and stuff like that. They all do it. Every single one of them.
It's a little disappointing.
Well, if it's not one doping of one kind, it's of another. And sometimes it's just trying to use like science to your advantage. Like, for instance, some athletes do like high altitude training so that their bodies become more acclimatized to low oxygen atmosphere. So when they're put in oxygen atmosphere, guess who's the rocket man? Is that cheating? Because you have access to a facility where it's higher up in the altitude? It's so much gray zone, sweetie. I don't even want to think about it, which is why the job of trying to do dope detecting seems like more politics than anything else. Mm. Did you have the money to develop sophisticated steroids that can't detect? Or are you a shitty country where you didn't have that advantage?
Very controversial.
I know. Sports, professional sports nowadays, I mean, you think it's a testament to the human body. I think it's a testament to the fucking power of science.
The Olympics is basically an event where you're seeing people, you're seeing what the human body can do, but you're also seeing these people who have worked and worked and worked all in
their entire lives, pretty much.
Yeah, their entire lives, all experiencing, like,
for one moment.
For one moment. This is going to be, you know, this is the most important moment in their life, and you get to see their faces, and you get to share in that emotion, and that's really beautiful. And that's kind of also what was great, in a way, about the Mars rover landing. So, after this weekend, we had
what's the Mars rover landing? Hello, I am a person who's been living in a cave.
I was going to explain.
For years. Oh, okay. Well, do it for the cave people.
Okay.
Like, start really basic.
All right. So this weekend, Jake and I had to run that prop festival, and we got home on Sunday, and I couldn't sleep because I was too excited and pumped, which ended up being great because I was able to watch in kind of-ish real time.
With whatever the delays of speed of light. And,
yeah.
And broadcast. They probably have a broadcast window.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Saturday Night Live had to after Andrew Dice Clay started saying fuck all the time. Yeah. There ain't no live TV no more, people.
Not real live. So I got to watch the live stream of the Mars rover landing. Now, the Mars rover landing, you know, a lot of people are asking, why is it so important? Haven't we been to Mars before?
Right. Didn't we have 2 rovers there?
We did have 2 rovers there. In fact, there's been 14 successful trips to Mars of some kind, of like an orbiting satellite of some kind.
That seems like a lot.
It seems like a lot, but it's not a lot when you realize that we sent 40.
It's not a good ratio of success.
No, we sent 40.
That's less than half.
I'm not 100% sure if this the Curiosity lander is 41 or is 40, but I think it's that the Curiosity is 41, which brings the stakes up to 15 to...
Which makes 40. You realize that the entire endeavor, especially when you consider, like, the tale of the 7 minutes that you get to watch, which there'll be a link in the notes and probably on the site as well, you finally understand what is the challenge of landing something, a planet so far away that it takes you 14 minutes to be able to receive a signal at the fastest speed we know. And you're just like, oh, well, it's got to handle everything itself. We create these sort of like little robots that are pretty much automated. And all you do is you kind of wait and say, please turn on. Please work and don't have the, you know, the possible 50,000 things that can go wrong. Now, I don't know if that's how many, but knowing the average space program, that's how many things can go wrong. 50,000. That's the average checklist of sending shit into space.
Mm.
It's like, 50,000? Oh, God.
Well, people kept trying to say, you know, the question that was on everybody's mind before the landing, before the 7 minutes of terror. Now, the 7 minutes of terror are the 7 minutes that the Curiosity was out of communication with Earth. Now, what happens is that once the Curiosity started its landing process, it was a 7 minute landing process, it couldn't communicate with our station back here on Earth.
Because of what? Interference? Or?
I think partially it was interference, but I think partially it also had so much to do. So what
right.
they did.
Don't overload it with other things. Just do your thing, and if it fails, well, it fucking fails.
Yeah, so what they did was they timed it so that one of the orbiting satellites around Mars would be able to monitor. Our Curiosity.
Was that what one of the pictures of the parachute thing
yeah,
came from?
Yeah, that came from one of the orbiting satellites.
It, you know what it looked like, actually? It looked like a little Nintendo pixelated parachute. That's what it looked like. At first, I'm like, is that a little video game like Chopper on the Super Nintendo or something? It almost looked fake. But no, it's real. Well, unless you're Joe Rogan, then you think that all space exploration is fake.
Don't get into that.
No, I won't.
That's very fresh.
So the 7 minutes, it's descending, and because there's not much of an atmosphere, this presented the problem, and their solution was the space elevator,
well,
which is
actually,
the craziest thing.
No, there was four levels to the solution. So what's happening is that the atmosphere in Mars is thick enough that it will burn up
It will create enough friction if something goes down too fast.
Yeah, to burn it up in the atmosphere, but yet not enough to slow it down. So when it's entering into the atmosphere, it's going crazy, crazy fast. So what they needed to do is they needed to slow it down a bunch of times. So as soon as it enters the atmosphere, a chunk of it comes off. And then that's why we ended up, you guys see online, there's all those pictures of that saucer. The saucer wasn't what was going through space. The saucer was what was, you know, when the main part of it broke off, and that was what was landing. And then the saucer deploys a parachute. And the parachute is, like, it's going faster than the speed of sound when it's plummeting. So this parachute had to withstand speeds faster than the speed of sound. That's crazy. That's
a strong fucking parachute. I mean, it sonic booms were tearing apart the Concorde. Remember how they had to retire that?
Yeah.
I actually got to see the Concorde at the Air and Space Museum in Washington. It was cool. It looked, you know, the windows were so fucking tiny. They were like smaller than a human head.
What?
Just minuscule windows. They could not put thick windows on there or big windows on there.
Why?
Probably because of the stress of supersonic speed on everything. It's just like it's a constant. Like there's a reason why it makes a boom and sound and that kind of stuff. I was curious. Remember your friend Nikolai who. He has a whip. He cracks that whip, and it makes like the craziest sound. The thing I wanted to ask him, and I don't think he could have answered this, was how much force is generated from that boom, even from like a small amount of boom? Because I'm hearing it from pretty far, and remember, sound is just vibration. So obviously, you needed to create a lot of vibration to make a sound that high pitch. But I'm like, is there other forces at play? Like, is there wind forces, or does it? I mean, it obviously affects the structure of stuff. But I've just wondered how much impact does it have? And well, you know, if there's anybody out there that can answer, please email me. But because I want to know how fucking awesome was that parachute to survive that kind of like those kinds of speeds and turbulence?
Yeah.
Although I assume with a thinner atmosphere, it must not be as great of a force, right?
It's pretty scary. So, okay, so we have to think about, so we've got two levels right now. So first of all, this saucer element broke off from the main part of the shuttle when it was on its way into Mars to try and slow it down so that there wouldn't be as much weight. Then we have this really incredible revolutionary parachute being deployed. Now, that's not going to slow it down fast enough before it reaches the surface, because what we sent up there is the size of an SUV. Like, the Curiosity rover makes everything we've sent to Mars before look like Tinker Toys.
Yeah, but they are Tinker Toys. you can have... They're like the size of a tiny coffee table.
Yeah, this is taller than a man in the size of a Mini Cooper.
This is... You know what? Well, this was a big deal. I think they said... per American, it was $7
per American. It ended up costing, actually...
$2.2 billion.
Yeah, it was $2.5 billion if you include all of the spacecraft development, science, and investigation, and the cost of the launch and operations.
Right.
So it was $2.5 billion if you include everything. But, I mean...
Still only a fraction of the military budget of the United States.
Yeah.
Which is at $700 billion.
Ugh, God. Think of how many rovers. Anyway, so now we've got the Curiosity... loses a chunk of the Curiosity. Now we've got the cool saucer thing. Then we got the parachute. Now the parachute's not going to slow it down fast enough. So what they did was they have jets that are pushing down to slow it down.
You may remember if you're one of those old school guys like me, they used to have a Moonlander game that was on the original, I think it was Windows 95. And you had to use the boosters and stuff like that to sort of like land it. Well, it's like the same thing, except for you don't really get to control it. You have to do all these things anticipating the forces way in advance.
Oh God, yeah. One of the coolest things about the Mars Curiosity lander is that it landed, like it began its landing descent within minutes of when the math was done, when they were expecting it to show up. It was like a minute early, maybe. It, like, the math was so amazingly good. Here's the other cool part. Okay, so...
Well, that's what people don't realize. Sending stuff into space with precise trajectories is so mind-bogglingly, like... You have to be so precise that I was thinking about this earlier today when I was, I was reading a little bit about different religions as I normally do. And the one thing that I just kept thinking about is, you know what has the power to predict the future? Science, right? It does predict the future. In fact, it was so reliable that that's what religious people used to do. They used to use science to know when, say, an eclipse would come. And then make everyone believe that they did something to make the eclipse happen and then go away. And think about the kind of power you can have when you predict the fucking future. And I'm like, and you know, still other people are like, I don't really believe in science. I'm like, do you know why I believe in it? Because it can predict the future. That's why. Your little sort of like prophecies have nothing on the ability to send a gigantic SUV on a red planet within the accuracy of a hair's breadth. Fucked up, yo.
Well, and think about it this way. The Mars Curiosity took off 36 weeks before the landing started.
You have to do it like so far in advance. You're like, it's kind of like all the stuff that we send out that's going to reach like Pluto. And I think 14 or 13 that we're going to get like a probe near Pluto. And that'll be the next big thing. But you're like, all the space stuff that we're going to be talking about has already been sent out. We're just waiting for it to reach its destination.
So let me put it this way. You build this rover, you program it. And also the entire landing process had to be unmanned. It's all done through programming. None of it is at all being run from people on Earth because we can't communicate with the Curiosity. So what's happening is that 36 weeks before it's touching down, which they had to do all this math, all these crazy like computations and lines of code so that it would land perfectly. And there were so many people who thought that this wasn't going to work. And because
well, they have to be realistic, for God's sake. There's so many things that can go wrong.
In a lot of ways, there was so much to go. And
something always doesn't work, by the way. In every mission, there's always been some little failure. But, you know, that's why you have redundancies.
Yeah, and out of 40 trips to Mars, we've only had 14 successful
Well, this
trips.
Time, they I hope they stuck to metric and not imperial.
Oh, God, let's not talk about that embarrassment. So here's another thing to consider. When the spacecraft was approaching Mars, it was going 8,000 miles per hour. Then, when it hits the top of the Mars atmosphere, the gravity is pulling it in, and it hit up to 13,200 miles per hour. Okay, so here's the cool part. So it's going 13,000 miles per hour.
It's going like something like 10 times the speed of a bullet or something.
And
crazy.
Yeah, and they have the big 50-foot parachute to slow it down. Then they've got the thruster rockets that are pushing down into the ground. So here's the once they do the parachute, that's not going to slow down fast enough. So then the onboard system knows to engage these thruster rockets.
And can everybody remember how delicate this technology probably is?
Oh God,
I mean,
so
have you seen the stuff we send into space? They're wrapped in foil, paper thin foil, because you don't care about. Like, there's no wind that's going to tear your foil. Either something goes right through at the speed of 18,000 kilometers a second, or you don't touch anything, because space is mostly empty.
It was pretty crazy. So, okay, so this... So, yeah, 13,000 miles an hour. We got this crazy, amazing parachute. Now we've got thruster rockets. Now, the thruster rockets had two responsibilities. One, it was to slow down even faster, because we had to slow this thing down to 1 or 2 miles per hour from
13,000. Those must be some fucking booster-ass rockets.
Yeah, so, and not only that, but there was a small camera on the bottom of this particular packet, because it was supposed to control to identify the surface so that it could land in the correct spot.
So it had a kind of like software that could recognize topography?
Yeah, I believe that's what it was, because they were showing pictures. They were showing pictures of what that particular camera saw.
Man, the smarter the shit we send out there is going to be, the less work it's going to be. I think that in the future, once we have really much more sophisticated robotic technology, even avatars, I think that we're going to send to these planets. Like, it's way better than sending a human, people. Send a fucking cosmic avatar. But imagine the kind of things that they can do. Like, there's a girl, 17 years old, who just designed an artificial intelligence computer program to track breast cancer. 17 years of fucking age. And I'm like, did you create a neural net? I'm still having problems configuring my email.
That's crazy. Okay, so we got breaks off. Little flying saucer, and then we've got this, you know, 50-foot-wide parachute. Then we've got the thruster rockets. We're guiding it into position. But the problem is these thruster rockets are kicking up a crap ton of dust.
Right.
And because this particular Curiosity is equipped with, like, really sophisticated cameras, and part of its mission is to get some really nice HD footage, what they needed was, in order for it to not affect the mechanisms and for it not to affect the cameras, and honestly, so that it didn't get buried was another big thing, they had to then have a sky crane that employed nylon cord to lower it from this thruster-powered...
Well, so it wouldn't be too close to the ground to kick up even more dust.
Exactly. So the thrusters are up high, and then it's got this sky crane. So think about this. Math done on Earth 36 weeks ago is landing completely unmanned with no human involvement at this point.
Do you know what I want to see? I want to see that board meeting where they're like, okay, guys, here's what we need to do. We need to write down the formula that for a thing that's going to have a parachute, then thrusters, and then fucking sky crane, that has to be, and recognize its own topography,
it like
and all of this
fiction.
Has to be fucking done automatically.
It doesn't sound real. Like,
well, it is science fiction. Do you know what? Flying saucers are real, and it's us, people. Mm. We send flying saucers to Mars. If there were Martians, there would be like, I saw a flying saucer. Yeah, right, it was a weather balloon. We are the aliens. We're aliens!
Okay, so when Curiosity first took off, I was a little bit interested. I mean, I've always kind of been a bit of a fan of Mars in particular, because it is going to be the first planet we'll probably put our feet on if we ever put our feet anywhere.
Well, do you know what it was? Mars was Earth-light. It was... No, but it was. It was if Earth had not collided with that other planet, right? We would be Earth-light, too. We are Super Saiyan planet. We're the fucking merging of a gigantic ball of fucking iron and whatever else we had. And you know what our dejected parts are? The moon! The fucking rejects are the moon. And you know what? The moon is an inert, crappy-ass place that stabilized our orbit, slowed down our rotation. You know what? We're a motherfucking Super Saiyan planet. And meanwhile, Mars, yeah, it dies like 2 billion years ago, because you can't be a small planet with a small core. Every fucking planet has a lifespan. And you know what? Like, small planets, I don't know if this is a universal thing, but if we look at Mars and we can kind of understand the formation of life-forming planets, which is what I think Mars it was, since it falls within the Goldilocks zone, it had a strong enough magnetic field and water in liquid form.
We're not sure about that. That is actually the mission of Curiosity in a big way. That's why they landed it in what looks like a place that could have contained
Well,
water.
I got $10 that says, we detect rocks with magnetic fields.
Well,
I'm telling you.
We could. I mean, that's why Curiosity is there, but it's definitely too early to say that it definitely had water. And it's way too early to say it sustained life.
It's not too early to say it had water, because of deposits of gypsum they found on Mars, which already confirmed
liquid water, though?
Yep. Because gypsum is only capable, like, gypsum is essentially what happens when you have, like, a very, very powerfully salted area of water that stays in a liquid form long enough for these crystals to form into what's called gypsum, okay? There is no doubt. In fact, you can look at canyon areas around Mars, which show, like, exactly the kinds of formation that you would expect from giant floods that happened and carved the land of Mars. We know there were liquid. There was liquid on Mars. Here's what we don't know. One, how long was it liquid? Two, how long did Mars, was Mars capable of sustaining life? Because I think we will find it. I really think we will. Like, I mean, obviously, I'm open to this, to the possibility that I'm wrong, but I'm telling you, formations of planets are like these kinds of forces and things like that. They're just universal. They act the same way everywhere else, and we can make very strong predictions based on even here and now. Look, if I can know the composition of a star that is 100 billion light years away, I can already tell a lot about the kinds of planets that will be surrounded, the types of materials that will be made up, because the star's a clue. You know what I mean? Like, there's lots of clues. And Mars has so many clues for life, like, you know, standing water and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, plus, Olympus Mons, the largest volcano, is on Mars, which indicates an extremely active volcanic period. And if there's a strong volcanic period, I'm like, I would not be surprised if the core had at least produced some form of magnetic field.
Well, we'll find out. I mean, that's why curiosity is there. And Obama made a really interesting proposal that he wants to see men walking on the face of Mars, United States men walking on the face of Mars in 2030.
They want American moon men.
American moon men. You know, American Mars men.
Astro men.
And that's really cool. And there are 10 instruments in all on Curiosity. And most of them are there to figure out, was there ever life on Mars? Can it sustain life? And trying to figure out how we're going to ever send men to Mars. I'm not sure it's a great idea.
No, it's a terrible idea.
Men to Mars.
It's a completely terrible idea.
But it's great to think about. I mean, it's...
Sure.
It's raining.
The lightning and the thunder. If you hear it, it's just we have no soundstage. So you're hearing the sounds of nature. The violent sounds of nature. But, okay, here's the thing. Mars, as far as I'm concerned, is what a dead planet looks like. Okay?
Okay. But that's not the point. That's not the point.
I know it's not the point. I think that what we do, like, this is why colonization of Mars, in my opinion, is a mistake. It's a mistake because don't invest in dead planets. And what I mean by a dead planet is, look, if you're going to live on a planet, there's a couple of things you need to find out. Number one is, how much power does that planet generate? How much sunlight, for instance, does it get? Because that's a measure of its power. And how much power does it naturally generate itself from geothermal forces? Well, guess what? Mars is probably at a fucking almost zero for geothermal forces. That's a cold-ass bitch in space, and it's got barely enough sunlight. I'm like, fuck that shit. Look, if we can figure out a way to manipulate energy, which I think that we will eventually, Venus, even though it's a hot hellhole, we could turn that thing into, like, a much more interesting environment than Mars. It's got similar gravity. We just have to fix a really poisonous environment. And you know what? We're going to get a lot of practice with what we're doing here now. So in the future, I'm like, colonize Venus. I know it's a bigger struggle, but you know what? You need the gravity, because if you live on Mars, I think it's got 1/8 or something of the gravity. It's not good. It will fuck you up. Okay, you were born and raised and created an environment that has a specific gravitational pull. And if you're not there, your bones will deteriorate, your organs will fail. That's why we can't send people for an extended period of time. They come back and you're like, well, you're a gelatin now. We don't know if we can rehabilitate you because you're all kinds of fucked up. You know? You rely on gravity in a large degree to sustain yourself. You rely on its constant pressure to keep your body in check. And without that, it's a big problem. So I say Mars is dead. Send plenty of robots and fucking avatars and let's explore this world. But I'm like, colonize it? Are you nuts? Fuck that. I'd rather colonize Europa. It's a nice watery world with plenty of power coming from Jupiter. It's fucking awesome. Well, you know, again, I look at power generation as my de facto thing for colonization. Because guess what? All right? You need it. It's your fucking... That's where you start with. Power. So when you watched The Landing, by the way, You, the next day, I'm telling you, you were describing to me what happened. I was getting teary-eyed.
Oh, God, it was so amazing.
So the first thing, I think if you're watching the video, or like I'll try to describe it as well as possible, if you've never watched it. But the thing is, you have to understand that we mentioned it before, 36 weeks ago, these individuals put everything they had in this project.
Yes,
everything.
And also keep in mind that when you watch the video, the crew you're seeing has been the flight crew. That's who's watching it right there. And the flight crew has been in constant contact with Curiosity. That's their job. And for those 7 minutes,
doing little checks, like all the checklists I was talking about. That's what they do all day.
Keeping an eye on her, and this is their baby.
This is a cosmic baby. Yeah, it's a cosmic baby.
This is years of effort in research. This is 36 weeks on its way, and this is going to be responsible for 2 years of space exploration.
Well, minimum, because the other ones did, I think, 5 years. One did 7 years. I mean, it was better than anyone ever possibly imagined.
Mm-hmm. And here's the other thing you have to keep in mind, is that if this fails, like, for the people in that room, one, this is their baby. This is their passion. They are scientists.
Well, they're probably not going to get a second chance anyways.
That's what I was going to say. Most of the men in that room, like, if you look at their ages, this is what they will be known for. This is their last chance.
This is their legacy.
The most important, like in the Olympics, this is the most important thing they've ever done.
Yeah.
And so watching that is just such a beautiful moment.
Especially when you consider the fact that I'm like, you did it, guys.
Yeah.
You did it. And so, and I don't know if I can fully understand, like, your entire life's work leading up to that, and it was like, and then it lands.
So here, let me decipher, because when you were watching, I mean, I put it up on Facebook and somebody posted that they didn't understand why it was 7 minutes of
terror.
Such
a big deal.
Let me explain to you why that is 7 minutes of terror, so that when you watch the video, you'll watch it informed. So you'll react the way I reacted when I was watching it live. Now, when they go dark on Curiosity, all they have is the observer to figure out what's going on. They've got some crappy granule pictures taken from above.
They are pretty crappy. Because they have shields, right?
Have shields around them. So they're trying to figure out what's going on. So they lose Curiosity. Now they've got her heartbeat. So they know
there's a constant light sort of signal.
It's a beep. Pretty sure it's a beep. So they know she's on. And she's still functional. And so they're calling out the things that have to happen. And what's amazing is that the reason why this is so scary is there's 2 points of the communication where they say we've lost contact.
Well, it's similar to when somebody re-enters orbit. There are moments where there's
contact.
No contact.
And it's really not. You hear them say, we're not getting anything. And then the other person responds, that's
what
we expected. And then there's about, 2 minutes later, they say we've just lost contact. And immediately they go, there she go. And you can hear that they're very professional. These are trained men. And they know that they're being watched by thousands and thousands of people.
Well, for fraction of a second, they probably didn't, right after it landed.
They know they're being watched. And here's the thing. The weather was perfect. The wind was perfect that day. Everything ended up being perfect. But there
Well, weather patterns on Mars are actually very predictable. It's because don't...
Yeah, but 36 months...
I know. But do you know why they're really predictable? It's because, unlike Earth, they don't have a complex series of currents and things like that coming from a large body of water. They have, it's a bit easier to calculate. Just to put it in perspective. Mm. That's why Earth is a little bit harder.
There are also 4 other countries besides the United States who have machinery on Curiosity.
Did they get mentioned in the
I actually don't think that it's made public, and I think that's very deliberate that it hasn't been made public. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Is it because of American pride?
No. I actually think it's because I think one of them might not necessarily be, like, totally sanctioned, so they're just not mentioned.
Whatever that means. What do you mean by not sanctioned? What does that mean?
I'm not sure.
It seems sketchy. Is that all you're saying? Something's weird about
sketchy.
It. All right, whatever.
Hold on. Who else is?
No, don't Google during shows. We had a conversation about why you don't do that. Because it turns out that when we do shows, you don't know how to Google.
Whatever.
Like, it's a show-specific thing. You're usually pretty good at Google, but I don't know why when show crunch time.
Anyway, I remember when I had... when I was watching it live, I had the Ustream thing open. I had the Twitter feed open because I was watching people as they live tweeted. Because it was very informative, actually. Because there was a few things they said that I didn't know what they were talking about. And then I would see somebody tweet, like, parachute deployed,
And then links or whatever, that
kind of
thing.
Yeah, and I would get it. It would be a little easier to follow. And then I also had my Facebook timeline open so I could see people reacting to Facebook.
Jesus Christ, you're in real time in a lot of ways. Video, social networks.
Yeah.
Crazy maniac.
I know. It was such a cool experience. And
it was like watching the moon landing, but for the next generation.
It felt like I was there. Because it's like, you know, live tweeting, and I was just...
Well, imagine the moon landing with live tweeting.
Yeah.
And HD cameras. I mean, all these other kinds of things. You're almost like, I wish they had those.
But I remember during the press conference when they didn't mention the other countries, I tried to Google it that night. I mean, there might be information up now, and I got the impression, I don't know if I was just on some conspiracy theory website, but I got the impression that there are good reasons why they're not necessarily mentioning who else's instruments are.
Well, I think you said something about the fact that after the conference, they sort of like said, thank you, President Obama. Because it's a year, like the election's coming up, and I'm sure... That landing is like, without a presidency that supports science, we're fucked.
Yeah, it was very rah-rah U.S., rah-rah Obama. Yay, support of Obama.
Please don't put a Republican in, because then we won't have funding for science, is what they were saying.
As an international viewer, it was a bit frustrating to watch, but I was just so overwhelmed with the pride.
It's true. You know, like, at that moment...
I was appreciative of it.
Yeah, at that moment, I felt like, this is a moment for humanity, not the Roman Empire. I'm sorry, the American Empire. America.
So you're watching it, and one of my other favorite parts about watching it live was that you can kind of tell who's responsible for what. Because they say parachute deployed, and you see two particular people in the room go, yeah,
yep.
You know, little yeah. And then when they say, you know, thrusters.
The sky crane is good.
Yeah, sky crane, the one main guy points to a guy and goes,
I think
yeah.
The one main guy that did that was the dude that saw all of a sudden is like the new handsome face on the internet. You didn't see this?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One of them is like had a mohawk and a couple stars on his thing. He is now an internet meme, by the way. Like, you know, sort of girls who love science were like, oh. God, he's like,
hair.
It's almost as fucking awesome as the landing.
So the
oh, humanity.
So people on Twitter are so passionate, and like, you know, it was amazing to see who was up for it too. You know, Richard Dawkins tweeted, this is a huge moment for science. Lots of people were tweeting, and it was just great. It was amazing to see, like, and to know that I'm sitting, like, you can see the numbers on the Ustream, and you know that one of those is Richard Dawkins, and one of those numbers is me. And that was a really great moment.
You're such a geek.
I'm such a geek.
You know what you are? You're a geek for famous people that you respect.
I'm a geek for shared experience. That's what it is.
And well, this is one of those moments, for sure.
It was a beautiful shared experience.
I wish we had the numbers on how many people were sort of watching
it. You can see from the Ustream on the video capture how many people
Yeah, but
were
it's
watching.
Not just... That's not just the only place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure there's people watching on the news. But, I mean, probably not that many.
I just don't know what global awareness was.
Well,
and if it wasn't really that high, because I remember I was reading this article.
Slow, actually.
I was reading this article from this one guy who was trying to criticize NASA. He's like, in the old days, they used to really inspire us and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, excuse me. First of all, they have a fraction of the fucking budget that they had, because you know what, compensate with inflation, the total cost of sending people to the moon was in the trillions, okay? And if you said you need to spend $2 trillion, which is probably conservatively how much it would cost to send people to fucking Mars, and you said, well, that means that for 2 years you have no weapons program, somebody would be like, what are you talking about?
Here's the other thing.
And you're like, well, you don't need a weapons program when the top 20 spenders on the military are allies.
So here's what I implore you to do. We're going to put up two videos in the notes. One video is an explanation video done by The SciShow, which is an excellent show. If you're into science, you should definitely watch it. And Hank Green is obsessed with Mars. He's been the guy who runs it. He's been obsessed with Mars since he was 12 years old.
Can you believe that the Total Recall movie skipped Mars, despite the fact that if they would have made it Mars, I think they would have had a bigger deal? Because just around that time, I'm like, hey, we should go watch Total Recall. Isn't it about Mars? Well, not the remake.
Ah.
What?
So
let's watch the original tonight. We're watching Total Recall tonight.
We'll see. So watch that video. It's got a lot of passion in it. It very succinctly explains the complexities, even better, obviously better than I'm explaining it now, because I don't know
don't
clue what
I'm
it. Talking about. And watch that video first. And then when you watch the video of the 7 Minutes of Terror, please pretend like you don't know it was successful, and you will feel a tiny bit
the tensions
of that amazing experience. And they, you know, when they we are on Mars, that announcement, and they jump up and they're dancing around and like the lamest high fives I've ever seen.
These are nerd high fives.
Yeah, it's funny because you see everybody hug. And then they realize they're being watched, I guess, and they try high-fiving, and they're just scientist high-fives. They're like,
give me a science high-five, which means that I totally miss you.
So funny. It is just hilarious to watch. And then the main guy from the who is on the intercom says, time to see where curiosity will take us. And I freaking,
you teared up.
I cried. No, it wasn't. It was beyond tearing up. Okay. It was like full on. Science is so great. Ugh, what a nerdy moment. But I mean, if you rewatch the video and you know what you're looking for and you pretend like you don't know that it was successful, it is such an important moment when he says that, because it's just like. Yeah.
I love how you were defending this moment, by the way, online.
So, last night I posted on Facebook after I, you know, dried my eyes and I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't because then I was so excited from my event, and then I was so excited from the successful landing, and I didn't sleep much last night. But, I was reading all the tweets, and I decided, like, hey, I haven't posted anything, so I decided, like, I'm going to tweet. I'm going to be part of the conversation.
Of the movement.
And mostly I just retweeted people because everybody said what I wanted to say, so it was just, like, give credit where credit is due.
No reason to repeat what's already been said.
But I posted the two videos I'm talking about, I posted them both to Facebook and with an explanation of, you know, how it made me feel. And somebody messaged and said they didn't understand why it was so important, and I explained it.
Do you know why they said that, though?
Because they don't get it.
Because there wasn't a person there. And they think that is more meaningful. Like, for instance, I have arguments with people when I tell them that, like, the whole man thing is a waste of fucking time. And I know that people are like, but it's inspiring, and we need to send them there, and we need to conquer worlds. And you're just like, look, I don't actually deny that the fact is that we may escape this ball of rock at some point. But the challenges to make that feasible, and not only just feasible, but that has any scientific merit whatsoever, compared to the kind of science you can get when you send a fucking SUV-sized piece of science on a fucking planet that doesn't need to wear diapers or get fed out of a straw, then yeah, you can get a lot of fucking work done. That machine works on solar power, bitch. Do you? No? Well, then get in the back of the line, because until you do, or it's easy to send you there, the best science is always going to come from robots, and you just have to fucking live with it. And just discussing it, it's like saying, well, we made so much more advances, you know, because we reached the moon. The moon landings and putting men on there was entirely a political fucking reason. It didn't give us the best science. I mean, Russia was already sending fucking probes. And the probe that it sent that was supposed to land about 2 months before man did, because that was to be their whole, we're the first on the moon. Their thing crashed. So they didn't get to say that they were the first to really get good science and data. But if they did, they would have come back with better shit. Even a fucking primitive robot, because, you know, you send a human being into space and you have to deal with keeping them alive, and that is a hassle.
Oh, yeah, that's a ton of work. And
I mean, imagine if the 14 out of 40 had been for human beings.
Ugh.
Would we have accepted that? No. And until we can send someone there reliably where it's not that kind of fucking odds, then please do not send human beings there.
Well, and here's the nice thing, is that the crazy Curiosity SUV that we sent to Mars has 10 amazing scientific instruments on it, including a laser firing instrument that will fire at a rock and simultaneously analyze.
Dissolve it
and analyze it.
Of course, it's probably a high-powered laser. So it needs to, if it superheats it, it'll turn it into a gas.
Yeah.
And guess what? It can analyze gas better than it can analyze
it's
a solid.
And from it's a laser. It's so cool. It's
got lasers.
And here's the other thing. It's plutonium powder.
Okay,
can I
just put this out there? As an alien species, okay, let's all accept the fact that we're aliens now, right? With the shit that we're sending out into space,
we're aliens on Mars,
right? No, but I mean, like, just in general now. I mean, we can take that. We've been there so often, and we're exploring other planets. We're fucking aliens. We're the very gray-eyed aliens, except we're not gray. We have come in many different shades of color.
So as far as I'm concerned...
But we're creepy little aliens.
As far as I'm concerned, like, I posted this thing on Facebook and then I deleted it because I realized it was stupid. Because my original post on Facebook was that this was an amazing moment for science in the world and a moon landing level experience for our generation. Because in that moment I did feel that way, and then I realized that's overstating it a little, so I deleted that and wrote something else. But I am happy to see
but
that
look,
here.
But look, the moon is so close, baby. It's 350,000 kilometers from Earth. It's like, it's a spit away. It's so
that's
close.
That's not what I'm saying, though. That's not what I'm saying.
But I was using that as an example of saying, like, the moon is not another world. Mars is another world. Mars is a bigger deal in so many other respects because, you know what? We don't expect to find life on fucking on the moon, but we expect to find something on Mars.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that most people, like you were saying, think it's more important to send a person, and also most people think, like, well, we've already sent two rovers, so this isn't that big of a deal. But it is a huge deal, and I didn't post it to Facebook because I didn't want to spend the next 2 weeks defending that statement. But for me, it felt like how it must have felt to see the moon landing. It was so powerful. I'm tearing up. It was so cool.
She's crying right now.
I'm not crying. It was awesome to watch.
She's crying. Great. This is a genuine moment. Send your monies. Become a member now. Only genuine moments like this.
Shut up.
For $20 a year. No, I'm trying to capitalize on your genuine moment.
Shut up. So yeah, so it was amazing to watch.
Well, it's funny because, you know, in our couple, I'm usually the one that sort of like it geeks out a little bit more about space. But on this one, you totally have me beat. It's like, I would have expected me to give a shit. I mean, like, did you care? Like, I had to make you watch The Transition of Venus.
Yeah, but I don't care about that. I don't care about shit that's going to happen with or without us. I care about exploration. I am Space Indiana Jones. I want...
Fair enough. Like, I'm just... But, you know, like, for me, space exploration, I mean, it feels like a big deal because, you know, like you said it before, you're into the exploration part of it. But truth be told, I'm way more excited about the probes that are going to be in, like, Pluto or Europa or those kinds of things.
Oh,
like,
yeah, that's
going to
be amazing.
For me, like, I honestly... like, here's my first question to people, and I'm like, this is... In our solar system, the most exciting thing is that on Europa, there are these red, veiny things that are visible through the ice of the planet. What is that? What the fuck is that? Nobody knows. Nobody knows what that red shit is. I'm willing to bet it's some kind of fucking algae, bitch. Fucking life. I think that when we reach Europa, we're going to see it. And you know what's a really good test for that? They found an underwater lake in the continent of Antarctica. And this is our first test to see, can we design a probe that's going to go down there and not contaminate this new world?
Haven't we done that? Didn't that already happen?
Well, I believe so, but we don't actually know if we've contaminated them or not. You know, like, sure, you could say, like, hey, we did it. How do you know? How do you know? Mm-hmm. And the scariest thing is, what if there is, like, okay, an underwater lake in Antarctica and we fucked that place up, I'll feel somewhat bad.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still Earth and there's lots of other life going on, and that's not so bad. But what if you go there and you introduce a kind of bacteria, whatever, that's super bacteria. You know, that goes over there and, like, your pittance of life that was developing in this energy-poor world, we're just going to take over. You know, like the frog that takes over Australia. When you introduce, you know, sort of like, I'm asking, is Earth life really, like, super life? And if you introduce it to other elements, are we just going to take over? Like, as aliens, if we went to a new planet, here's the thing. You would contaminate that planet. The bacteria that's on your body, the shit that comes out of your breath. How do you know that stuff won't totally destroy their environment? You don't know that. You could kill every fucking living entity on a new planet the same way that 90% of the fucking Aborigine population of North America was killed by disease. Not by, like, someone stabbing them, but just by the fact that they had no immunity. Like in War of the Worlds. So, my question is, our exploration of the cosmos, do we become like the Ebola of the universe?
Bring stuff back too. I mean, you have to think about things both ways. Right now, we're not worried, like, our curiosity is not coming back to us. She's out there, and that's fine. But, I mean, there's a lot of talk about starting to bring stuff back.
I'm not worried about the stuff that comes back. You know why?
Why?
Because Earth is so life-rich that whatever they bring back is going to get totally decimated by a world that has had life on it for billions of years. The truth is, like, if you have some fucking... Like, again, I was mentioning energy, right? Earth is so energy-rich, it's sick. We're so close to the sun. Our core is ridiculously active. We have a stronger magnetic field than Saturn, okay? And that's a big motherfucker. We've got it all, baby. It's an energy-rich planet, so I think that the life forms that develop on this will compete with most of the other life forms on the solar planet. In fact, solar system. In fact, so much so that I'm saying we are the contamination, not the other way around. I'm not too worried about, like, space viruses. I'm like, you guys have got nothing on our viruses. Nothing. We've been evolving for 3 billion years.
As irresponsibly unscientific as this is, I don't want to talk about that.
You watch the astronaut's wife. You got paranoid. You never watched that?
No.
Johnny Depp goes to space. He comes back and he's all evil. It's Charlize Theron before she was a big deal.
That sounds lame.
It is pretty lame.
I know what I'm going to say is that, like, it just happened. I just want to be excited and see everybody be so proud of our accomplishments and do this thing that is science fiction and make it real. And, you know, it's so amazing. And another amazing moment. So, you know, he says, time to see where our curiosity will take us. Choke up, crying. And then
they got you.
I straighten up just quickly enough to hear the reaction to them saying, We've got thumbnails.
Yeah, but that was all funny, because who cares about thumbnails?
So funny! But, I mean, it was
but
important.
But scientists.
It was important, because it let them know, you know, they could see the wheel, they could see that they're...
Well, it's not just the fact that you land, it's like, are you working?
Yeah.
Because if you don't work, you're a big fucking expensive piece of junk we sent to Mars.
And here's the other thing, I don't think people realize how great the photos are going to be, because those photos were taken through the dust shield.
Oh, yeah, it's black and white, it's
black,
grainy as shit,
they
I'm like, that's...
full-color HD, they have 14, I think it's 14 full-color HD cameras on the thing.
Well, okay, remember when I showed you that HD footage of, like, the Earth's rotation,
mm-hmm.
and how you freaked out because you thought it was fake?
17 cameras, 17 cameras.
And you thought it was fake? I'm
We
have not tasted the beautiful fucking scenery and images we are about to have, and you know what, here's the beautiful thing. Maybe this is communistic, but maybe it's not, is that this is all free. You'll get to witness this, and you won't need to fucking pay one dime.
Yeah.
And that
Although
is awesome.
Although it sounds like, I'm not sure if I got this right, but it sounds like the orbiter is picking up the signal from Curiosity and slingshotting them back to the Earth. So I think it's going to be a while before we get something really
Well,
cool.
it probably makes sense, because if I was designing it, what I would do is, you know, if you have a transmitter... I wouldn't put it on the thing I'm landing on the planet. I'd probably put a much weaker one because, you know, who knows? If you're transmitting a lot of information, you're probably generating all kinds of fucking electromagnetic interference and things like that. And, you know, a sophisticated piece of technology like that probably has very sensitive equipment.
And, yeah, and I'm also pretty sure that they've got a, you know, it's going to be way easier for the Curiosity to send something really good to the orbiter and then for the orbiter to send better information.
I'm sure it's
space.
A beast with, like, a big giant fucking... you know, transmitter on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The orbiter is a badass. The orbiter is a fantastic transmitter. So it's probably going from Curiosity to the orbiter, then from the orbiter to an Earth-bound satellite, and then from there to, like, our computers. But, I mean, even the speed of that was incredible. And here's the other cool thing, is that because of the speed of light and its stupid slowness...
It's so stupid with its slowness.
So stupidly slow, we, you know, like, that whole 7 minutes of terror, it had already happened. It had already happened.
It's true. It had happened 7 minutes ago.
Yeah, and that's, I think, another reason why it was so tense, because, you know, they weren't landing it. Whatever was happening had already happened.
Yeah.
There was nothing at all they
could
do.
Well, everything had been done 36 months ago, like you said. Like you, yeah. Although, here's the thing. I'm sure in the future, we're going to bypass that bullshit with quantum entanglement, and it'll be sweet. But until that time, and I'd say probably about 150 years until we're actually, like, manipulating it that good, again, not people that we're sending.
There was another interesting conversation.
Robots.
Yeah, there was another interesting conversation that somebody mentioned on my Facebook page when I posted about it, was that they felt that
could have been spent to something
else. Could have been better spent.
Yeah, to fighting hunger. What did he say?
It wasn't anything specific. It was just that money could have been better spent on Earth. And my argument against that was, you know, like, my exact comment, I think, was...
That's pretty much the cost of one... A stealth bomber.
My exact comment was science should not be the first thing up for scrutiny. In terms, like, if we're looking,
no, it's a great response,
poor,
honestly.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I agree. That could have been. I think your fans know my obsession with children in famine.
Oh yeah, well, you've mentioned it quite a bit, and the fact is that we'll probably end up being involved in it in some way.
Pretty
because
quick,
you're
yeah.
not gonna you're not gonna let that one go.
Well, I'm already doing what little I can, but.
Right.
But it's very little.
Who knows what the future will bring, but I can definitely tell you that it'll have something to do with Carissa being involved in some kind of starvation prevention thing in Africa. Like, that's her thing.
Not even just in Africa, but just, you know, just children starving. Childhood starvation.
Well, I would say that a big portion of the concentration is actually there. Because it's pretty miserable there.
There's lots of places. Honestly, it's lots of places. And then the frustrating thing about it is that it's not really an issue of resources anymore. It's an issue of politics. And I mean... That's so overwhelming, because what are you supposed to do as a single person?
I know, seriously. But yes, they're aware of your passion for
anyway, so when they made that comment, like, that definitely got me, because, you know, I was so indulgently happy about the space exploration, and it did set me back for a second. I was thinking, you know...
Could it have fed, like, a, you know, 10,000 kids?
Yeah, and all I could think was that, you know, like, when you're building a budget for your house, is the first place you take the money out of your own education, or do you take the money out of all the beer you're drinking? Do you take the money out of...
The indulgences or the necessities.
Yes,
and I would
absolutely.
Say that science is a necessity.
Science is a necessity. I don't think any money spent personally or in our government or by our government to inform us and make us more intelligent and the steady progress of science, that is never money poorly spent.
Do you know where here's an example of money poorly spent. Roughly the same amount of money was being spent in the U.S. to create what essentially would have been their version of the CERN. And they abandoned it when they needed about, $1 billion more, and they had already spent 2.2. And let me tell you something. It's like, that is a complete waste. Because now you have a big gas tunnel underground that doesn't do shit. And, you know, like, the best science isn't coming out of the U.S. anymore. Even their own particle accelerator, which they're decommissioning, the Tevatron. Like, sure, it might make a few discoveries, but I'm like... You know, after they had discovered what they thought might, you know, like a 5 sigma level of assurance on the Higgs boson fucking particle. This is Switzerland, bitch. That's very far away from the place that has named more heavy elements, like, than any other country. There was a time where America was, like, discovering elements left and right.
Well, I think it's not a bad idea that we have, you know, countries focusing on one particular field of expertise. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
No, but all I'm saying is that the opportunity to discover that would have been open to the U.S. had they just committed to it. And their lack of commitment actually cost them the exact amount, practically, that it cost to send Curiosity into space. And now, if Curiosity had failed its mission, just like the way that particle accelerator did, we may have lamented that money. But was it a waste? Like, what is waste? Really? And I'm like, failure is not waste. If your money went somewhere into an idea that didn't work, I don't think that's waste. It's just because, you know what, like Edison said, he learned 1,000 ways to rip people out of inventing a light bulb. But, you know, failure is a necessary part of it. I'm glad that it succeeded. Don't get me wrong. But... What would be the conversation we'd be having if it had failed? Right? Like, oh, well, we should have gone somewhere else, or it's not worth it, or, man, NASA's wasting all our money. I always feel like scrutiny is heavy on these guys, while we don't complain that the same amount of money, or probably more, is spent paying companies for not having honored defense contracts in the U.S. You know, a significant portion of defense monies is actually paid to not produce weapons? It's to compensate companies. who, you know, don't end up manufacturing them.
Seems very odd to me.
Well, they, you know, companies can sue the government, so a lot of money goes that way too. I mean, it's just like the money that could be spent elsewhere. I'm like, oh, you're gonna pick going to Mars and trying to find like more evidence of life. This is what you think is a waste. I am just shocked. I'm like, I know that these are financially strapped times. I mean, like, we didn't send rovers to Mars during the Great Depression. But if we had the technology, we sure should have. Because the benefits will always outweigh the costs. Every single time. I don't even care if I can't tell you directly what the benefit will be. It will. It just fucking will. There's no losing in this kind of thing. All right, let's move on to the next subject, which is more, is it kind of depressing? Because we're gonna skip past the most depressing part of it, actually. Because here's the thing. You remember how there was that whole Aurora thing we did our last show on, and it was horrible, and you're like, we had a whole gun control discussion, which ended up having some really interesting comments and that
really?
Kind of stuff.
It did. I need to be more diligent and read. I'm so afraid that somebody's going to say they hate my guts. I stopped reading comments a while ago.
You're so sensitive.
I'm so sensitive.
I'm just as sensitive, but I just accept that if someone says something negative, like, I can't exist on the internet and not accept those.
I just feel more intimidated by it. Like, you know, sometimes I get negative comments on some of my YouTube videos and things like that. I feel like that's okay. Because I know the YouTube ball game, but I just feel like most of your commenters are already so nice.
Right, they're also ingrained. They're not like newbies that just found the show.
Yeah, and
when
I get a negative comment from one of your commenters,
God, that happened like 2 years ago.
No, there's been a couple. Sometimes I get emails that are like, I didn't like your opinion on this. You're dumb. You're a dumb girl.
Okay, well, first of all, you have to be nicer on Chris, because the odds are you love me a little bit more than my co-host. And if I say something and one of my co-hosts disagrees, you might have a lot of hatred on them, and don't do that. Don't hate them more because you love me.
That was a weird conversation.
Bad. I think it does happen, though.
Maybe.
Look, if you have an opposite opinion to me, and someone's like, "I love Jacob," and then I'll say something, even though I might be wrong, they may hate you for it. In fact, if I lose the argument, you had right, they may hate your guts. So, I'm sorry.
I don't know. Our first debate, the Santa Claus debate, I still feel like I won.
Totally not.
I totally won.
Nope. All right. So we were finished with the Aurora thing. We had some interesting discussion. And then, you know, like not much time goes by. And all of a sudden it's like, hey, there's a new shooting tragedy. Except for this time, it's a white supremacist who goes to a Sikh temple and opens fire.
Now, here's something interesting about it. I have a question for you. So I've heard it. I read a couple articles about this, even though I rarely read about this kind of stuff because it's
depressing.
Bombs me out. But some of the articles are identifying it as a hate crime, and some of them are identifying it as domestic terror.
Right.
I don't understand
the difference between the two things. What does domestic terrorism?
What is domestic terror?
That's not really okay. Here's the thing: domestic terrorism is not really specific. I would say that domestic terrorism normally amounts to any action by a group that is against the government. Like, there's plenty of, say, independent little militias, places that really take the Second Amendment seriously, or Thomas Jefferson's statement that every few years, every generation, there should be a bloody coup. Well, you know, some people will kind of, like, take that to heart and establish freakish splinter cell groups that rely on violence to get things done. I think for the most part is that any time where an individual will target a group, for whatever reason, they might be classified as a kind of terrorism, right? Because you have to understand that the man who did this, his name is Michael Page. He's a white supremacist. And, you know, like, any time something like that happens, you know what happens. We dig through their internet presence, because that's the best way to get information, apparently, about someone. And what they had found was that this guy was part of a pretty heavy metal band, a white supremacist metal band, that was talking about the problems of multiculturalism. He had, like, a tattoo after 9/11. And really what his problem seems to be, because it's difficult because he's dead now and we can't get that, you know, like, his own statement from it, is that he seemed to have a problem with the fact that people were in his country that were not white or Christian. Hmm. And, you know, truthfully, I don't know what percentage of Americans feel that way. Because a lot of individuals that might identify with this guy hide it. They're obviously aware that their racism is embarrassing or whatever. And they might hide that degree of prejudice. But here's what I feel. I feel like right now this incident, these kinds of incidents might actually be a little bit on the uprise. And the reason I say this is because, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's a general, like, a lot of white people now are starting to feel very threatened. The fact that there are more non-white babies being born in the United States now than white babies. It's actually reached that point. So I think that,
Who's being threatened? Like, what? Where are you noticing this?
I'm sorry, what do you mean?
Like, you're saying it's becoming apparent that white people are being threatened by this. Where are you getting that information from? I haven't noticed that personally at all.
You haven't noticed a resurgence of racism? Like,
no,
I'm
not looking for it.
Okay, well, you're not looking for it, but there was a good example. There was a Baptist church in the U.S. that refused to marry an interracial couple.
Okay, but that's one thing.
It's not just one thing. Like, you have to understand that these kinds of incidences were actually, like, relatively rarer even a few years ago. It's just that what you've noticed is that it's now become, well, I don't want to say trendy, to be a bigot. Take Chick-fil-A as a perfect example, right? Mike Huckabee goes over and like, we need to support Chick-fil-A for its discrimination of gay people.
Ugh.
And the arguments that are being used by the religious right in terms of why they should be against homosexuality are the same arguments that are being used by segregationists, essentially segregationists, that are against the idea that colored people should marry white people, whatever that means.
Can I make a quick comment about the whole Chick-fil-A thing? I just want to make one little comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
There was this Tumblr meme, because now I'm all about Tumblr as well. Every week I pick another social network and I become obsessed.
Don't do that.
I don't watch much TV, though. That's what I do.
You watch a lot of YouTube, which is the equivalent of TV.
I was going to say, that's what I do. I'm obsessed with social networking. That's my TV. I just watch YouTube.
You like TV 2.0. And interactive TV. Yeah.
There was this one thing that got popular where I'm not exactly sure what the image was, but it was comparing what the Oreo thing and the Chick-fil-A thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say something that's, to put this into fucking perspective, because that, I didn't comment on it because I knew I'd get shot down, because the kind of people reposting that are fucking morons. But here's the deal. It is not the same to support equal rights as it is to discriminate against a group of people.
That's true.
That is not the same. Period. Okay? Saying everybody should be equal is not putting down straight people. The difference is, the difference would be if I went to a party and I said, hey, we should all have beer, or if I said, only these people should fucking get beer, and these people should not.
And these people will eat dog shit.
And then someone said, well, those two are equal because, you know, some people disagree
because
with your comments.
Because two people have different opinions.
That's fucking bullshit, and I could not possibly have been more pissed off by that statement. It is not fucking the same to support equal rights as it is to discriminate against a group of people.
Do you want
to
know why you should love Oreo even more now?
The same.
Did you see the Oreo rover thing?
No.
They had an Oreo with a red filling and, like, tire tracks on it.
What?
I know. Oreo is awesome.
Oh, my God.
Let's go buy some Oreo cookies.
Oh, we are so buying Oreos right after this.
Not a sponsor. You know, Oreos are for us. Oreos are our cookie. Because it gets what we want. Okay, let's go back to this whole horrible tragedy. So basically, this white supremacist... I know, I just want to just mention it.
You're harshing my mellow about
all right,
the rover.
So this white supremacist goes to a Sikh temple, he opens fire, and kills a bunch of people, including the guy who started the temple, who died trying to stop this guy.
Wow.
I know, it's actually pretty sort of like heart-wrenching. It's like the same thing with the Aurora. Guys were like trying to save their girlfriends getting shot. As horrible as these kinds of tragedies are, they remind you of how awesome people are. Where they're like, I will sacrifice my life to save people. I will sacrifice my ability to exist. Because I will shield the person that I love to give them only a few more brief moments. of that existence. And you're like, that is like, in those rare moments of tragedy, we always see that, I mean, I don't want to say it in a cheesy way, the human spirit, the part of us that really sort of like transcends these kinds of like tragedies. And I feel that's where we are. I mean, like, Michael Page is a racist piece of shit. We don't need to think about him very long to realize that there's absolutely nothing interesting about him. But there's a lot interesting about the people that, you know, that died, the ones that unfortunately had to sacrifice themselves for the good of others. And I'm like, I want to mention this before I actually talk a little bit more about Sikhism. Because, you know what, after this happened, and the funny thing is that obviously this man's frustration was based on the fact that he hated Muslim people. Yeah, Sikhs are not Muslims. But they do have a very similar shade of skin, which for a white supremacist piece of shit is just about enough.
So I was confused. Like, I remember when this first happened, I researched it very briefly, and I remember reading an article that tried to briefly sum up Sikhism, and it was not well done.
It really wasn't. You know what? I had to. I really wanted to understand, okay, well, what is Sikhism? What's the deal? What is it? You know, like, where are the influences and that kind of stuff? Okay, so number one, if you understand Sikhism, you have to understand Indians and their obsession with gurus. That's the first thing. You know what I'm talking about, right?
By Indians, you
mean? People from India. I don't mean, like, the incorrect nomenclature for Native Americans, but I mean people from India.
Just for clarity purposes.
Yes. Indians. So, the first thing you have to understand about Sikhism is, like I said before, it's a guru-based religion.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the 15th century, there's a guy called Guru Nanak, who's essentially the founder of the religion. And he has a very, very similar story to a lot of religious figures. Like, he becomes religiously aware at a very young age, is teaching teachers about stuff. And okay, here's the thing that you have to understand about religion. Whenever you have a story about a child teaching someone else, that's a religious story. Because in the real world, if a child comes over and tries to teach you about quantum mechanics, you tell him to shut the fuck up. Because he has no facts. He has nothing. But in the world of religion, where a child can be just as knowledgeable as an adult, it seems like a really significant thing. You're like, that kid was telling adults about God. Yeah, it's a fucking fantasy world. And you know what? Same thing will happen if you are over 27 years of age and you go online and you try to play video games, teenage kids will beat you. And you just have to live with that.
My favorite is still trying to learn After Effects. And the
from
best,
an 8-year-old kid?
The best tutorials I could find were all this 8-year-old kid doing screen captures. And it was sad because half my brain was going, oh, this is so good, great, now I know how to do that lighting effect. And the other half of my brain was like, great, I'm an idiot.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like part of the, anyways, like I was saying, there's a similar story with most guru, like most religious leaders. And he has the whole being wise as a kid, experiencing the suffering and pain of others as the Siddhartha Buddhist kind of thing. But you have to understand that, first of all, Sikhism is extremely influenced by Hinduism, all right? So the main guy, Nanak, his parents were, like, one of them was a Hindu, and the other one was another part of a group or whatever. But they were part of a lower social caste, okay? And this is very important when you consider the type of message that Sikhism has. So I want to actually go through the concept of Sikhism in case you're like wondering what the fuck they believe. So the first ones, they believe in one God, so they're monotheistic. They believe that God is omniscient, omnipotent, and he is transcendent, but he's like the Spinozan deist God, everything. So every part of your interaction with the world is an interaction with God.
Okay, so wasn't it already determined that you can't be omnipotent and omniscient?
Well, see, this is a logical contradiction, because if you're omniscient and you already know what you're going to do, then it's difficult to be omnipotent and choose what to do because that future's already been determined.
Yeah, so you can you can be all-knowing and all-powerful, but it's very difficult.
Well, you create a kind of logical inconsistency that can't be resolved using our human logic, which might be, you know, maybe there's a way. Maybe there's a way that is consistent that we're not aware of. But I'm just saying that as far as we've understood it mathematically, that is a kind of inconsistency. So okay, so he's transcended, blah blah blah, omniscient, omnipotent, blah blah. Okay, so here's a couple things that they do believe that's important. The sort of ways they are different from every fucking other religion that could, you know, like right now that could say they share some similarities. So number one, they do not believe in miracles. And I think the reason they don't, although I'm not 100% sure because I've only been researching it for a few hours, like a maniac, but still only a few hours, is that I think that the way they interpret God is not a force that really interferes with things, right? His whole oneness, and why I say it's very similar to Spinoza, is that it seems like their God is just a force of nature, right? They also, like, part of their thing is that they believe in a soul, and they believe that part of the whole process of Sikhism is to reach a sort of oneness with the soul of God, because they also believe in reincarnation, but they have this whole aspect that you can avoid this dead end, you know, coming back to Earth by having a complete fusion, I guess. I don't know how to call it with God. Like, do the Super Saiyan thing with God, and you'll be all like, I don't know, the world is awesome. Now, in terms of religious traditions, I have to admit that at first, when you look at this religion, you're like, well, this is actually a pretty tolerant religion as far as most religions go. Because from the very inception, they preach tolerance. In fact, some of their own edicts were actually invented by someone of a different faith. So I think that you have to understand that at the time that it develops, I mean, they're mostly under Muslim rule, although there is some hint of, you know, Hinduism that's still going on. So it's a very pluralistic kind of world that their original guru lives in. But his experience, Nanak's experience, is kind of similar to that of Muhammad. So he disappears for a little while in his 30s as an adult. And when he comes back, he says he's had a revelation from God for a number of days. Although his revelation is different, isn't it? Says, well, basically, you know, they're like, it's, you know, when Muhammad had his revelation, it's an angel. He's telling him about things, blah, blah. With Nanak, it seems more detached. It seems almost similar to sort of like Buddhism in a sense, where it's like one of their things is that they have a non-attachment of their five evils. Okay, this sounds a lot like Buddhism, by the way, are ego, anger, greed, attachment, and lust. Again, like I said, these sound very similar to kind of like Buddhist traditions, right? This sounds a lot like Dharma. In fact, the concept of Dharma is brought up a lot in the religion. They also have this whole thing where there's no drugs, no sex outside of marriage, or no eating of sacrificial meat. So they're very, very, very conservative about how you treat your body. They're the body is your temple kind of people. And Nanak himself stressed that like religious rituals, pilgrimages, and all those kinds of things were unnecessary. The way to achieve sort of like oneness with God is internal rather than external. Now, the irony of that, of course, is the fact that the later gurus did exactly the opposite, where they established rituals. Like, for instance, most Sikhs have a number of aesthetic rituals, which include their turbans, a little knife called a kirpa, like a bracelet that's supposed to represent infinity and that kind of stuff. But like any religion, it never obeys the tenets that the original founder kind of thought up of, because those don't lead to stable religions. If I have a religion that says it's in you, I can't really charge a membership fee or any of those other kind of things that you need as a political movement. So, and you'll notice, actually, the history of Sikhism is a history of change. Like, even they themselves will admit that with each guru, and there have been 10 gurus so far of Sikhism, each guru has implemented a new kind of concept of how their religion is supposed to evolve. Like, one guru in particular, I think in the end of the 15th century, was murdered. Because he had taken part in he had given resources to a rebellion that had been quashed by the government, and because they felt that that guru was part of the rebellion, he was executed. And because of that execution, the Sikh religion became more militaristic as a consequence, and it evolved their religion to sort of like, want to develop their own independence, their own land, and things like that, which eventually caused a kind of extremism in their religion, which led to... Do you remember the Air India thing in Canada? You remember that? There was an airplane in the 1986. There was a terrorist attack on an Air India flight from Montreal to London to India. It killed something like 280 Canadians, like 22 Brits, and I think like 15 or some odd Indians, things like that. And the reason for that explosion, or the terrorist attempt, was because the year previous, the Indian government had issued a pogrom against Sikhs. Because what had happened is that the president, essentially, the prime minister of India, which was a Gandhi, was murdered by her Sikh bodyguards, which led to a pogrom against Sikhs, and some, like, thousands of Sikhs got murdered, had to be displaced, and the year after that, there was a kind of independence movement that had sort of arised, and they were kind of like a what's called Khalistan movement, and Khalistan, it was their imagined utopia. They were like, let's create a government in the Punjab region, because that's where the majority of Sikhs are. Let's create our own government, and it will be called Khalistan, which means, like, the perfect place or whatever. You know, like, where other religions are not. You know what I mean?
The only us zone.
The only us zone. So, yeah, Air India crashes. For 20 years, by the way, the Canadian government tried this. We spent $130 million, and we convicted one dude.
Oh.
Yeah.
What?
So, you know, but here's the thing. Religious extremism on the Sikh side was pretty much contained to this Khalistan movement, this independent movement, but it has since the end of the 90s died out. And for the most part, like, I want to go back and I want to read a couple other things that Sikhs really believe in. Because, I mean, I think we'll all agree that this is a pretty... Like, I'm not afraid of Sikhs, okay? I'm not afraid of their extremism, because, you know, like, they don't believe in cutting their hair. That sounds like Nazarene kind of thing. They also think that life is more precious than a diamond. Like, that's their whole thing. I know. Sometimes they can conflict with that. But, you know, that's religion for you. But they're all like, human life is precious. They're a bit of a humanist group. They by the time... When they were created, they were actually very for women's liberation and women's rights and things like that. So they were a very progressive movement in India, because I think that, you know, in India, women don't have that many rights, and it's pretty disastrous. But, you know, so there's that. And they also, they believe that a person should work hard and should be charitable. And that you know, like, disparity between, like, you know, like, people should be tried to, you should try to regulate that using... You know, like, your essential love of mankind. It's not a bad thing. You know, like I said, I mean, like, they have three main precepts. Share with others. Help those less in need. Earn an honest living without exploiting people or committing fraud. And the third one is chant the holy name of God. But the problem with this religion
is... most of that.
Yeah, the problem with this religion is it places emphasis on the third thing. Rather than the first two things. So, and this is where most religions go bad, is that as soon as you sort of, like, place an importance to the immaterial, that's a huge issue. And, you know, like, remember what I said, one of their gurus got killed? This led to, at least in the 17th century, an increased militancy in Sikhs. They even had their own little empire for a while. But, you know, like, even a religion that starts up is saying, we're all about mankind and happiness, will turn into a violent... group, because inherent in their philosophy is an otherness. And I don't think that can be resolved. Even though Sikhs promote tolerance, it didn't prevent them from having an extremist group that killed like 360 people for no other reason than they wanted to have their own country where other religious people would not be invited. And you're like, well, as peaceful as your religion claims to be, what is the result of this idea that only you possess the truth? I think that makes you kind of like psychotic, where you perceive everyone else as a liar, even though you promote tolerance. You still think they're wrong. You know? And what about the more violent element of the people who believe in what you say? They're not going to have the same tolerance you do, man. They're going to think, these people are infidels. Let us fucking kill them. This is the inevitableness of every unreasonable idea that's ever been thought of that cannot, that doesn't merit, that doesn't accept scrutiny. I mean, does Sikhism accept real scrutiny? Is there any way to disprove it? I'm sure they don't accept any of that.
Well, I think something to think about in this circumstances. I mean, it may be not the best time to give them a dig. I mean, they're suffering a terrible tragedy.
True.
But I mean, like it's the same thing with every religion. All the same problems. You know, no different. It's just heartbreaking to know that this happened, and you know, it makes me wonder what was going through that weird fucked up man's head when he did this. You know, not even to do his research and figure out.
Well, he hated multiculturalism. He viewed it as a way of diluting Christian white culture in America.
That's heartbreaking.
And you know what? There's lots of people that feel that way. They may not have a violent intent, but they still feel that way.
Well, I mean, right now, I'm re-listening to the audiobook for A.J. Jacobs, The Know-It-All, and he says a wonderful quote in there where he says that when he was reading the encyclopedia, he saw all of the tragedies of humanity and all of the wonderful things, and the good only incrementally outweighs the bad. And I think that this particular show is a wonderful example of that, where it's just
We had a longer part on the Discovery thing than we had on the whole Sikh thing.
Yeah, the good in the world incrementally outweighs the bad, and
but that is humanity. That is humanity in a sense. I mean, it's a dirty process of us growing and evolving. But you know what? Like, honestly, when I looked at the principle of Sikhism, I saw it as a kind of natural evolution of Hinduism, right? Because Hinduism has a concept that is very similar to a monotheism, where they think that there's sort of like one primary God creator. But for the poor people, and I'm not shitting you, they have a religion for poor, and they have a distinct religion for rich people. And the religion for rich people is more metaphysical, and the religion for poor people is more like, you have this list of gods, and these gods do this. But you can understand that even in Hinduism, there's a bit of an evolution, and I feel like at least the egalitarian, humanitarian elements of Sikhism are a response to Hinduism. But with that in mind, when in the ancient world where movements had to be religious in nature, because I think that that's where most people felt motivated, we don't live in that world anymore. And we should not. Because I don't think that religious movements, revealed religions, are good. I think that they're just another form of nonsense. I mean, like, the main precept of Sikhism that really disturbs me is that it says, don't listen to yourself, listen to gurus. And right there, I'm going to tell you, that's evil. That's a bad advice. And right there, it makes that religion completely worthless. And that's it. And now you know what Sikhism is. So at least you don't feel like a fucking total ignoramus. And if you want to find out more about the 10 gurus and what they were all about, I strongly suggest you research that, because each guru brings their own flavor. And I feel like if you want to understand Sikhism, understand the 10 gurus, their history, and you'll know the religion. And at least you won't be as ignorant that fucking racist, white supremacist piece of shit that killed what I believe are tragically ignorant human beings rather than anything else. I'm like, you guys believe in some nonsense, but there was no reason for you to face any consequence to that. You should have been allowed to believe that, and that's it. And some piece of shit took that away from you.
Heartbreaking.
Indeed it is. Well, you know, before we leave the show, I'd like to remind everyone that this is the final week for the Indiegogo campaign.
Oh my God!
Yeah, by the time you...
That's a big deal. How close are we to getting to where we were on Kickstarter?
We are about 5,000 away from it. So that's a lot, especially considering the last days. I'm going to be, now that Light and Motion is done, I can devote more time to it. I'm going to be spamming your asses. So my apologies, first and foremost, if you have not contributed to the Indiegogo campaign, because there's about 100 of you that have not switched over from the Kickstarter. Please, you will not receive the book if you have not switched over. The campaign was canceled. We're now on Indiegogo, and despite my reticence of that program, please go on and support. This is the only Indiegogo campaign you'll ever need to support, by the way.
For those of you who have already switched over, I do have to say we're incredibly grateful.
Like, absolutely.
When we had to switch over, it was horrible.
It was so funny. Like, you showed up at the house because you were supposed to do a practice, and you were like, I need to go home. Jacob's probably all fucked up, but I didn't even have time. I was, like, busy trying to do the whole Indiegogo thing. And actually, I think you got home and you were surprised.
I was surprised. I think I was, that day, I was more upset about it than you were. But I mean, I think your upsetness was diluted over that week.
Well, I just, you know, it was one of those things where I just didn't feel like I had time to be upset. It's just like, you got to do this. And in a way, I felt like because I had already done the Kickstarter thing, it wasn't impossible to do it on the Indiegogo side. I just felt like I'm like, Kickstarter was the Cadillac mm-hmm. of campaigns. And now I'm with the Pinto.
Well, let's turn this pony around and take it from a very upsetting thing
to say goodbye to like about 19,000. Yeah, but you know what? Like there were so many people who were like, I donated more, and I thank you because I'm sure that there's some people who are like, I don't want to really give to Indiegogo. So with that in mind, all of you that were hesitant, please, like, I really want to beat that the amount we had in Kickstarter. It would feel like a big victory, and we have the time to do it. So thanks everybody who's contributing. Remember, the basic one is $10, and that's for the ebook.
$10.
Honestly,
helps.
It's worth it. Even if you're like, well, it's not totally written yet, give me a fucking break. You pay $60 for a game that's not done, and you're gonna have to pay $10 for like a book where I've already covered up to judges, and we're gonna go on next week. By the way, for the next bonus show is going to be Ruth and Samuel.
Is it going to be you and me, or?
I'm not sure. It depends because, Ryan was supposed to do this show, but he just had a nephew, and he's
congratulations,
Ryan. So if you want to send your congratulations to Ryan being an uncle,
so awesome.
Send Ryan Harkness@gmail.com. Send him your congratulations and congratulations.
You and Ryan both, I think it's in like within a month.
Within a few months, we've both been uncles.
It's amazing.
It's cool. New life is coming on this earth, man.
Yay!
And hopefully we can leave him a good home. Yeah. Not filled with religious violence or...
But filled with scientific discovery.
Scientific discovery. Yay! Okay. Well, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Chris Hendricks.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody. Bye.